too close to call, but, you know, with postal votes still to come in, it might be difficult for me to get there, but you never know.
Welcome to this week's edition of Eye on the Peninsula, Tuesday the 5th of July, with Labor candidate Peter Murphy commenting on the 2016 election. More from Ms. Murphy later in the program. Good afternoon, I'm Piers Cunningham, broadcasting from the RPPFM studios in Mornington. We can all breathe a sigh of relief now, the 2016 federal election is over. But with a hung parliament looming, there will be unrest and instability ahead. Today we speak with Ms. Murphy about what lies ahead in the seat of Dunkley. We also focus on Liberal candidate Chris Kruther in the marginal seat of Dunkley on election night. Allegations have arisen in the Summers concrete footpath dispute, with an opposing Summers group accusing the Mornington Peninsula Shire of misdemeanours and misrepresentation. We learn about a fundraiser to be held on Bastille Day, hear talented singers from Padua College, and listen to what kids had to say on their trip to Point Nepean National Park. But first, it looks like the result of the 2016 federal election will be a hung parliament. With the coalition needing 76 seats to remain in government, it will be days, even weeks, until we know which party will form government. Malcolm Turnbull says he's quietly confident of forming a majority government, but nobody can really say with certainty what the outcome will be. Closer to home, member for Flinders Greg Hunt keeps his safe Liberal seat with 45,847 votes, followed by Labor candidate Carolyn Gleisner with 34,674 votes to date. Dunkley Liberal candidate Chris Kruther is feeling quietly confident with the results so far. He addressed friends and family last Saturday evening with this.
Well, firstly, ladies and gentlemen, the first thing I would like to say is, we did it! And it has taken a team effort. I really appreciate the work of every single one of you here today, who have been at booths, who have been on phone calls, who have been out with me all the time. You've all been fantastic. It's absolutely great to have the honour of being, I guess, very close to being selected, but not quite there yet, of course. I really will honour the privilege of representing you as a potential member for Dunkley, and I look forward to working very hard on behalf of this community. But Greg Hunt has been a fantastic help. Neil, he backed me through pre-selection. David Morris as well, the member for Mornington. These are all MPs I look forward to working with very strongly. It's a team effort, state and federal, to work towards great results here on the peninsula. I would actually like to thank my opponent in this campaign, Peter Murphy. Peter Murphy has been a very strong campaigner. She's fought very hard. She had a lot of backing, I'd also mention Jeanette Swain, the Greens candidate. She's also been a strong campaigner here as well. Now, Bruce, again, you've done a fantastic job. So lastly, I look forward to being a very strong representative on behalf of Dunkley. That's the most important thing. As a representative, I will fight extremely hard for this electorate to achieve results as Bruce has achieved over the last 20 years. It is a community that benefits. It is the outcomes in this community and in our nation that are our most important thing. It needs good people in Parliament, good people that can work together in a team to achieve results and improve our society over time. I know Bruce did it, and I look forward to doing the same. So thank you very much, all.
On a personal note.
Very excited, and my wife Grace and I have worked extremely hard right up until the election date. Like Bruce, I want to be a very strong advocate for this electorate. It is a fantastic place to live. It's got the best of the country, the city and the coast, like I always like to say. It's the Riviera of Melbourne. It's a fantastic feeling. There's a lot of work ahead to make this even better place than it even is now. I look forward to working very closely, along with my wife and the team and everyone around me to achieve outcomes and results for this electorate. Bruce Bilson's done a fantastic job over 20 years, and I look forward to working like Bruce on behalf of the community, putting the community first as its representative in Parliament. Thank you very much.
This from outgoing member for Dunkley and former small business minister, Mr. Bruce Bilson, who held the seat steady since 1996.
Well, it's a very exciting night. It's one of very strong mixed feelings, but I'm just thrilled for Chris and the team and Grace, and very excited about what Chris will be able to do for and with our community for the years ahead.
Now, you've left a high
Oh, look, I think he's well equipped. His heart's in it. He's very capable, as you've seen from the campaign. Very engaged in the local community. So I have very high optimism about him being an outstanding local member. And any support and encouragement I can offer, I'd be honoured and thrilled to do that.
A big job for Chris, but with AEC resuming the count today, with the Libs at 34,717 votes over Labor candidate Peter Murphy with 34,279 votes, the win could still go to either party. Now this from Peter Murphy. Is she confident she can win her seat?
It is still too close to call, but you know, with the postal vote still to come in, it might be difficult for me to get there, but you never know.
Do you think Mr Shorten, though, can form a minority government?
I will leave it up to Bill Shorten as to what happens up there, but I think it's obvious that Malcolm Turnbull has absolutely no mandate. Bill Shorten ran such a terrific campaign and talked about what is important to people, you know, had a positive agenda about providing great education and healthcare and infrastructure, dealing with climate change, you know, marriage equality, all the things that people really care about and are important for now and the future. And the theory of trickle-down economics and tax cuts for big business, you know, is not what the Australians wanted to hear. It's very clear.
Ms Murphy was very happy with her achievement.
We got a great swing towards us in Dunkley, no matter what the outcome. And I think it was a combination of factors. I think it was that we had nationally and, very important, locally, a really great positive agenda. You know, locally we talked about having an actual plan, which involved, as you know, because we've talked about it a lot, education, mental health, investing in infrastructure in a way that would lead to jobs and opportunities for locals, the massive investment in TAFE, and healthcare, making sure that people have access to healthcare no matter where they are or how much money they've had. And we didn't run a campaign which was about pork barrelling or small announcements here or there for various little groups. We actually ran one with a real agenda. And I think it was that, combined with the fact that I was so privileged to have the most amazing group of volunteers. The people I have met that have come out and worn red T-shirts and been on the Dunkley campaign are some of the most amazing people I've ever met.
But do you think you may have lost some votes, though, because of the CFA issue?
The saddest thing about this election campaign is the way that the Liberal Party, Malcolm Turnbull, all the way down to the local candidate down here, tried to use firefighters and the issues in the CFA to get political traction. And they pitted volunteers and professional firefighters who work together in all of our stations in Dunkley all of the time and do an amazing job against each other for cheap political gain. And it is not only sad, quite frankly, it's a disgrace what they did. And they campaigned very hard in Langwarrin, and at Elizabeth Murdoch College in Langwarrin, the booth there, we got an 8.5% swing towards Labor.
Wasn't there some people from the union, though, to do with the CFA at some of the booths as well, that Libs could have got a bit upset about, or that people who were against what the unions were doing to the CFA?
At the polling booth, there were firefighters there who were absolutely dismayed at the way the Liberal Party have tried to attack them and their colleagues and use them for political gain. Out of pocket for pathology, or to go to your GP, or paying your rent and putting food on the table. That's what people talk to me about, and that's what I'm really proud that we ran a campaign which was actually about people and what they wanted to hear for the federal election. And we got, at the latest count, as I'm talking to you, a 5.2% swing towards Labor in Dunkley. An amazing result.
If the Liberals do get in to Dunkley, what next for Peter Murphy?
Well, I won't be going away. I mean, I love this community. I'm part of this community, and in various ways, I'll continue on the boards of, for example, PenCoff, which helps to raise money so that we can have social workers on the street dealing with youth homelessness. I might take, if I'm not so lucky as to be the member for Dunkley immediately, a couple of weeks, perhaps spend some time with my husband and my dog. but I'll be around. I mean, this whole experience has been so fantastic, and the people that I've met and that I've been able to spend time with, I just want to continue to do that.
All right, well, just lastly, how would you feel about being part of a minority government, assuming Mr Shorten can do a deal with the minor parties?
If I was lucky enough to get over the line at the end of this.
Yep, that's
and
right.
Was, I couldn't express to you how delighted I would be, because there would be the range of initiatives that we've promised here, starting with the one we did before the election even started, of the business case for the electrification and duplication of the line to Baxter, all the way through to the final commitment on the last day of the campaign. There is one thing I would like to say, and that is thank you for the opportunity that I've had during this campaign to be on your program and to speak to people. And I'd also like to very much thank everyone that has spoken to me when I've knocked on doors, made phone calls at polling booths, community groups. It's just been an absolute honour to have had the chance to talk to all of those people.
Deborah Maher reporting. Later we'll hear from kids about their experience in the tunnels at Point Nepean, but now... Iron the Peninsula is following the Summers Special Footpath Scheme and Summers Community Group, who are for and against concrete footpaths in the small coastal township. Constructing concrete footpaths in Summers is on the Mornington Peninsula Shire's agenda. It's a complex issue, with community groups going head-to-head at a VCAT hearing to be held in October, with the Mornington Peninsula Shire involved. Allegations that the Shire has been keeping information from community groups are heating up, with accusations the Shire has been lying. We begin with part one of our report with former Mornington Peninsula Councillor David Gill, who speaks out about the allegations. These are the community groups involved.
There's the Summers Village Community Association, which is a new group that are formed out of opposition to the existing Residents Association, Ratepayers Association formerly, which was in favour of the scheme and pushed for the scheme since 2009. The SRA is the group that is in favour, and the SVCA is the community association that's been recently formed, which is opposing the major changes to a coastal village. Mm. 5.2 kilometres of concrete paths.
Seems to me there's been a bit of bullying happening in one specific group of people.
There's been some bullying in the past in Summers, but it's come from the SRA, the old group, the established old group, who have... said, we have to have this and we say so, and we're right. And the action has come from, in this case, 500 people have been prepared to go to VCAT to argue that, no, you don't really represent us and you don't tell us what to do. We'll decide. The people of Summers will decide. And that's what this has been all about, the people of Summers deciding and not a few people who have decided to take all the responsibility onto themselves without sharing the views of other people.
Which individuals approached VCAT?
VCAT has to be dealt with by individuals. Groups can't approach VCAT or submit to VCAT. So several individuals from Summers have instigated the appeals to VCAT about the Summers footpaths, concrete footpath scheme.
And were they from the Summers Residents Association?
Two of them were, and one was a third party. If it gets to the formal appeal, it's very difficult to win against the council.
Who's paying for this?
Well, the ratepayer's paying for the council side of it. That'll amount to a huge amount of money for barristers. The appeal is being paid for by fundraising from the people, and only the people in Summers who are affected.
Do you know how much that is going to estimate?
I know that the lawyers come very dearly. So it gives you an idea of what sort of battle when David takes on Goliath.
And what are the main issues now?
The main issue has always been that the people of Summers do not want concrete paths, but they were misled right from the beginning by the SRA, which is the Summers Residents Association, and the council, into believing that it was something different. All the information that was put out to people in the area, they were told there was going to be narrow, meandering pathways which would look after vegetation. Then they were told that it would be exposed aggregate. And a lot of people didn't realise that exposed aggregate is just concrete.
Is it the one that has the pebbles in it? Is that
yeah,
what
the pebbles are not ploughed under. In the normal concreting of your driveway, for instance, the people doing the concreting will just trowel under the stones, or they can allow them to stay on top. So that's the only difference. It's still concrete. But what people in Summers wanted was an investigation on what the needs were. They also wanted an investigation of what people actually wanted. Did they want concrete paths or not? And that never took place except for the Summers Residents Association, in conjunction with the council, running some surveys, and we really detest by how they ran those surveys and how misleading they were, and the information in them was totally misleading to people at Summers. It was just a few people who wanted concrete, people who had previously lived in their other lives in Paran and places like that, who retired to Summers and wanted to bring concrete with them.
What's the percentage, do you know, of people who don't want the concrete footpaths?
Well, it's a great question, because in normal circumstances, and most people realise, a petition is easy to get people to sign. So if you get 500 or 600 people signing a petition, it sounds really good. But in this case, there were 500 people who went to VCAT. In other words, they were co-petitioners to VCAT, and that's a major step away from a petition. That means that you're actually putting yourself up there. You're not just, you know, signing your name and...
So I thought you said there's 3 people went to VCAT, but now you're saying 500 went to VCAT?
Well, you have to have an initial person, and they're the people that VCAT deals with. So each of the 3 appeals to VCAT has to have a head person.
And who's that?
Pam Bannister is one, and there's 2 others.
And yourself?
No, I'm not on the head of anything. My role, and why I'm so interested in this, is that I lived in Summers. I became a committee person for the Summers Foreshore Committee. I saw the way the Summers Residents Association treated Summers, the way they did things without really knowing what people wanted, and they were really concrete and clearance people. No, this has got to stop. It's got to stop somewhere. So a new group was formed, and my role was that, because they knew that I'd have a background in local government, just to give advice.
What argument are people putting forward who want concrete paths?
The people that wanted the footpaths used the arguments that they were looking at safety. And then, of course, the first thing to do was to go to the local police and say, well, have there been any accidents? And we found out there'd been none in the last 10 years. We thought, well, why do you want to have concrete driveways past people's houses where cars back out and people riding their bikes on shared pathways, which to me seems to increase the likelihood of accidents. Mm,
but that happens everywhere, you know. I mean, even in built-up places.
In most built-up places, you don't have shared pathways for people riding bikes on the footpath. Now, you've got to remember that Summers is a coastal village. It's a small population. You asked previously how many people opposed it. Well, 500 people signed up, but we couldn't get access to most of the people because over half of the population doesn't live in Summers. They're holiday houses. The Summers Residents Association managed to get to those people because the council gave them the access to those people through giving them the addresses. But not only did they give them the addresses, now we found out that they paid for the postage. When the Summers Community Association asked for the same right, they refused. In fact, they were put through a 4-month period of having 16 alterations being asked for by the local council. And each time they agreed to one, and then it went to the next one. After 16, all agreed to, the council said, we don't like your tone and we're not going to post your letter out. Then we found out that the letters that went out from the Summers Residents Association, remembering there's 2 separate groups, we found out they didn't even bother to check their letters. And that's why we're annoyed that one side of the argument is financed by the council and the other side isn't. One side has access to everybody in Summers because they posted to everybody whether they lived in Summers or outside of the area, and the other side couldn't do that. The other side could only go and knock on doors, which they did, and they found that an overwhelming number of people didn't want concrete paths in Summers. And we're talking about 5.2 kilometres of wide concrete paths.
So why the big deal with Mornpan Shire paying postage to the value of $13?
Well, you're saying $13. That's the reply to me when I wrote and asked how much did the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council pay to send out the information on behalf of the Residents Association. And the council replied, $13. And that was for the labels. They also added the cost of about $100 for officers' time. But when the matter went to VCAT, we found out that the council had to admit for the first time after 12 months of denial that they paid the postage. Now, postage is thousands of dollars. We're talking about big money. We're talking about one letter to go out. We're saying there might have been 10, 15, 20 times, because the SRA, the Residents Association in favour of the concrete path, put out a lot of information They have their own newsletters. They have special letters that have been sent out. And we still don't know how many times the council paid for that information to go out, at the same time refusing the other side of the argument.
So are you going to get to the bottom of it?
It was interesting. Several weeks ago, it went to VCAT for the first time, and it was a directions hearing. And the council argued against having an informal or formal session before the formal hearing. So you can have a sort of informal area where you can debate, ask questions, try to get down to the bottom of it. And it's really like a mediation. The council lawyer, in conjunction with the council, argued against it. They didn't want a mediation. They didn't want any discussion. They just want the formal hearing. And the formal hearing basically means there are narrow legalistic grounds of appeal. And probably, in most cases, residents have got no chance of winning against a council with barristers and solicitors. This is now going, in a few weeks' time, to mediation before it goes to the formal hearing. Now, I'm hopeful that the council will stop this whole nonsense before it gets any further.
Sounds like the Shire isn't doing its diligence in the interests of the Somers coastal seaside community.
The council have argued that the concrete path life is 30 years. A gravel path will cost more over that lifespan than concrete in maintenance. We heard this at the council meeting. The next day, we went to the infrastructure team at the council, which does the on-site works. And we asked them, do you have any problems with the gravel paths in Somers? Do you have a budget for Somers? Do you have a regular maintenance of paths in Somers? And the answer was no, no, and no. In other words, no money is spent on the gravel paths in Somers. I think the councillors have been ignorant. I think the councillors have been kept in the dark. I think the councillors haven't bothered to ask questions. They've had 80 questions from the public at council question times, but the councillors haven't followed up. They haven't wanted to know. They haven't bothered to investigate the answers of the officers, and we have. And one of the reasons, I believe, is that we've got a new CEO, Carl Cowrey, with no background in local government. He's appointed a lot of younger people to senior positions, and I think they're out of their depth. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know how to handle when people actually find out the true facts. And there's been a cover-up. And the cover-up amounts to keep the councillors in the dark, mislead people, and now they're at VCAT. And now they're in big trouble because they have to tell the truth at VCAT. They can't just mislead. They can't just say whatever comes off the top of their heads because the evidence will show otherwise.
That completes part one of a two-part report, which will conclude next week, where we cover the special footpath scheme and Cerberus Ward Councillor David Garnock responds. Ahead, Padua College students showcase their talent. But now, Bastille Day is in a couple of weeks, and even though it's France's National Day, some locals will be celebrating at a dinner to raise funds for a camp for children living with autism. Statewide Autistic Services CEO Kath Ferry speaks to Deborah Maher about the event. We begin with Kath explaining the role of Statewide Autistic Service, known as SASI.
Statewide Autistic Services was actually started by a group of families back in 1966. The families were looking for assistance for their children who were on the spectrum, and with the lack of government services they started to create their own, and that's where we formed from. A group of families who were in desperate need created a whole range of services that we still continue to provide today. We're a not-for-profit and a charitable organisation.
So you need fundraisers then, because the government doesn't subsidise you?
No, unfortunately, the government chooses to limit resources, although we look forward to the National Disability Insurance Scheme, because that's going to give the money to the person who's receiving the services, and then it's up to them to choose where they wish to spend it. And obviously we're hoping that, you know, in the realm of services we provide, that families will choose us.
When's the NDIS going to be rolled out?
In Victoria, the start of the rollout is 1st of July. In the area which this radio station covers, which I'm imagining is Bayside Peninsula, we're actually at the end of the queue, but in some ways that's good because they can roll out lots of the issues prior to that. So we're actually due to go live in March 2018, which I know is a long way away for families, but I figure that really it's better to get it right and then we gain the benefits from mistakes learned in the next couple of years.
How far has research progressed with diagnosing autism?
In the last probably 10, 15 years, there's been much interest in autism, particularly in the US and the UK. In Australia, the federal government set up about 2 years ago the Autism Research Consortia, which is based in Brisbane but has partners in all states. And there's been lots of developments and interest around research into early intervention with children who are diagnosed, but not as much research into perhaps lots of the people who we support who were perhaps diagnosed maybe in the 70s and the 80s when research wasn't as far advanced. So it's now, well, how are we actually researching how those older people are managing and what kind of things can we actually look at to enhance their opportunities to link in with the, you know, with the community like everybody else, because they didn't have the benefit of early intervention.
Do you think that there's a risk of autism being over-diagnosed?
It's an interesting question. I used to work with GP networks and specialists, and it's a question often GPs have asked. And I think that the diagnostic tools have become more and more, there's a broader range of tools available to people to diagnose, which were not previously available. So I think the fact that the incidence in terms of, I mean, at the moment in Australia, it's about 1 in 100 children are diagnosed on the spectrum, or children and adults actually. In the US, it's around 1 to 66, which is significantly more. But I think a lot of that is that people are actually understanding autism, the fact that it is a spectrum. Somebody who can be very mildly affected or somebody who can be very severely affected, and all stations in between. So it's a very difficult thing to diagnose, but the tools are certainly much better nowadays.
Has a spectrum chart actually changed to incorporate more children either side of the so-called spectrum?
There has been much discussion in the medical fraternity around the diagnostic. There's something called a DSM-5, which is a diagnostic manual, which back in 2014 or 15 was changed. And a lot of the people who are diagnosed at the Asperger's end of the spectrum and some of the other sort of disorders fell out of that grouping. But on the other hand, I think there's more likelihood that more people are captured in the spectrum because of a lot of the diagnostic tools and some of the symptoms and things that, you know, people present with. So I think, you know, there's a, you know, the diagnosis has improved, the services and things haven't kept sort of pace with that. So lots of people and lots of families are very frustrated because their child may be diagnosed, but where do they access services? How do they fund those? And there's more and more demand. And I think the NDIS has shown that currently in all the trial sites, the highest disability represented is people on the autism spectrum, which is around 26% of the current people with plans, which is quite a significant number.
No, there's quite a significant number of children living with autism down on the peninsula. And that's why the Abacus Learning Centre was set up in Hastings. They do fantastic work. And Greg Hunt, the Minister for the Environment, of course, member for Flinders, walked last year and raised over $50,000 to go towards the new facility. Do you do much work with Abacus Learning Centre?
No, we actually don't do a lot of work with the Abacus Centre. We are certainly aware of the good work that it does on the peninsula, and we actually joined Greg Hunt in his walk both last year and when he did the first one, I think a couple of years ago now. We provide predominantly at the moment a lot of services for people who are 18 plus, so a lot of our people access services once they've left school. However, we do also provide respite and recreation for children between 5 and 18 at school holidays, weekends, you know, and those sort of things, and after hours. So, you know, we work in the same space, but we're in slightly different geographical areas.
Cathy explains the fundraiser on Bastille Day.
We've had a bit of a fundraising strategy around taking a large group of the people we support from our Beachland Day service, which is in Seaford, and services families from in and around the southeast area. So we're hoping to actually, before the end of the year, take them on a camp of their choice. So they're very excitedly looking at places to go. I don't know whether or not we'd manage the Gold Coast, but that was one of the choices. So we've started on a fundraising strategy. We already had the support of the Mornington Race Club in Hats and Hooves last year in 2015 and raised some money at that. We're putting on the Bastille Day fundraising dinner, which was suggested by Lucy Nicholson, who is a well-known opera singer who is a SASSI ambassador and also the mother of a child on the spectrum. And she thought that, you know, people like French, they like the celebration. It's an opportunity for people to get together, have some French food, champagne. Lucy's very kindly donating her time to sing, and we're having silent auctions and things with the hope that we're going to raise the rest of the money to enable us to take as many people as we can on a camp before the weather gets too hot.
What's the total you're looking for?
Already got in the order of around $8,000 or $9,000. We'd like to double that at least.
So be able to take more children, obviously.
Absolutely,
on this camp.
Absolutely.
If you want to join all the fun with French Flair and help raise funds for the camp for children on the spectrum to enjoy, visit the SASSI website, sassi.org.au/events. That's SASSI spelt S-A-S-I. Soon we'll hear from some kids who experienced the tunnels at Point Nepean. And coming up, some local talented singers. That's three talented Padua College students. Recently, 13 students from the Padua Music Department collaborated and recorded a CD called Unfolding Stories. The CD is a collection of songs written by the students who share their personal stories. Deborah invited three of the singers and Head of Performing Arts and Music, Mark Manick, to the RPPFM studios to discuss their achievement. Mark starts with Padua Music Department.
We're very proud of our music department at Padua, and we're particularly proud of it because of the students that make it up. We have a bit of a philosophy that no matter what sort of music kids are into, we just want them to get better at it, be it classical, rock and roll, heavy metal, Zimbabwean rap, we don't really mind. We just want the kids to run with it, and we've got a lot of good teachers that help them.
There was a CD that you just brought out not long ago called Unfolding Stories. Whose idea was it to put it together?
Okay, well, we run a vet music class, which is based on the music industry and learning how the industry works. And as part of that course, the students learn songwriting. We've now got our own recording studio at the school. And this last year, we did our songwriting unit, and these guys just took off with it. I showed them the basics, but that was all I needed to do, and off they went. They all started writing their hearts out and did a fantastic job, and we thought, why don't we make a CD out of it? Get a bit of exposure for the wonderful work that these kids do.
How long did it take to do the recording from start to finish and produce it?
Probably took us about 8 or 9 months all up, from the first track we put down then to finishing them all off.
What was the age of the students ranged from?
So basically 16 to 18. Some kids in year 10 and 11 were on it as well.
Is this the first CD you've done?
First CD I've done at Padua.
Well, I couldn't believe how much talent there is in one school. You'd be very proud of what they've achieved.
We're all very proud of them. They're very clever kids.
Deborah introduces Gabrielle Parker.
That's Gabrielle. I'm going to introduce you to her now. Good afternoon, Gabrielle.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us in the studio today. Beautiful song. Did you write it and also do the lyrics? And what's the name of the song?
Oh, thank you. The song's called Breathe. And yes, I did write it and do all the music for it. And I've been writing for many years now. So it's been really fun to actually get it to put it on a CD.
What genre would you call the music?
I'd probably call most of my songs a ballad in the singer-songwriter kind of spectrum of music. I write most of my songs from my own personal experience, and I find it a really good way to let out my emotions and to comment on the world around me and things that I perceive.
What's Breathe about?
Breathe's about really finding your own place in the world, especially when you've had a bit of a hard time. And it's really about finding your own place in the world and a place where you can be happy and really shine in your own spot and breathe, really.
Do you want to further your music career?
Oh, definitely. If that's what's meant to happen, then I hope it will. And if not, then I'll just keep writing for myself.
Have you entered into the voice of Frankston?
No, I haven't, but I know many people who have that have done really well, and I'm very proud of them all.
Do you think that music today is as good as it was, say, 20 years ago, and why?
I think there's always people with a spark that's going to create some beautiful music, and everyone's got the ability to make something beautiful, and I always think that there's going to be people that are going to make wonderful music to make people happy and to make them feel things.
When you wrote the music, what came first for you, the lyrics or the melody?
I think for this one, the lyrics mostly came first because I was just sitting down and it had been a bit of a stressful day and I was thinking about where I wanted to be rather than where I was, and so that was helpful.
And lastly, do you play an instrument?
I play a little bit of piano and I mostly sing.
And are you playing piano on your piece?
No, my good friend Riley Duncan, the talented pianist at Padua College, has been playing on my piece and he's a great help.
We're just going to hear a little bit more of Gabrielle, and thank you very much.
Now for Chloe Kirkpatrick.
That's Chloe Kirkpatrick who is playing there, and that's your actual song and lyrics, and you're playing the piano,
yes,
Chloe?
Yes, that's right.
Welcome to Eye on the Peninsula. Now, tell us a little bit about the music that you wrote here and also the lyrics.
This was the first song that I've written, and I found it quite hard to find the lyrics, and I always try and write songs that relate to me personally and also that can relate to somebody else if they were hearing it in their own way. And the way I related this to myself was a relationship that I have with my sister. And I took that and I tried to, yeah, express what I was feeling about her. And I guess it's the best way I could tell her without just talking.
The song is called Change.
Yes.
And it has a positive message, doesn't it?
Yes, yes, so it does.
Delta Goodrum is your idol.
Yes.
I certainly sound like her a little bit. Have you actually contacted Delta? Maybe you could get on The Voice and...
Yeah, well, I have sent letters and I have met her personally.
What came first for you, the lyrics or the melody?
I would say that the music came first. I guess difficulty trying to express myself in a way that I feel comfortable and in a way that I would want the audience to perceive what I'm saying.
It's very interesting when you look at artists who are on stage, yet off stage they're very quiet people. It's almost like you said that they do hide behind their music,
yeah,
and lyrics, and they're happy to share what they feel and think through lyrics rather than having to talk face to face.
Yeah.
In a conflict situation.
Yeah.
Is that how you found it with your music?
Yeah, well, I definitely think that, and that was especially, with Change, kind of avoiding the conflict and saying what I wanted to say about my sister without actually having to say it to her. So, yeah, she doesn't actually know it's about her yet.
We're just going to hear a little bit more of Chloe as we go on to our next guest.
And lastly, singer Jade Nye.
Jade Nye, welcome to... Eye on the Peninsula. Fantastic song that you
Thank
wrote
you.
And you're actually singing as well.
Yes, that is me.
Black Noise. Tell us a little bit about Black Noise and where you got the inspiration from. And is it from personal experience as well?
It's a little hard to describe. When I first started writing it, it didn't really want to show itself to me. In the process of writing Black Noise, I came across a number of different songs, all completely varying with different inspirations. Until the beat started to show itself just around my life, I just had it stuck in my head. And I came to the realization that there's something in this. And so after that, I moved on to the bass and then the other instrumentation until I added the lyrics later on. And the title, Black Noise, I've had that sort of refrain in my head for a while now. It's a bit of a play on words as I took it from white noise and just flip the colour to black noise because I thought it gave a sense of it's looming, and unlike white noise, which doesn't need to be listened to, black noise has this presence that needs to be heard.
So what would you call the genre of that music?
That's a bit of a tricky question. I would probably put it under alternative. As I said, I draw a bit of inspiration from everywhere, so a bit of Lou Reed, but then there's a bit of jazz and Cohen and all sorts of places, a bit of hip hop. And so I can't really say what I'd really call it.
It's a Jade Nile genre.
It's a Jade Nile genre. It's exactly it.
So when did you realise that you just had that beautiful voice?
I can't really say where I started singing. I was born in Long Island, New York, and spent the first 2 years of my life there. And until then, I don't think I've really stopped singing. It's just sort of carried on from there. And then I've picked up bits of how I want to sound, and so it's a lot of depth, and then my belting and my own technique is sort of my own interpretation of how singing should be.
You mentioned Leonard Cohen. He's well before my time and your time. How did you get on the bandwagon with Leonard Cohen?
Hearing his lyrics and the poetry in his lyrics really inspires me with my own lyrics, because it's sort of an implicit meaning. So it can be taken to its own significance to everyone, because there's the poeticism in that. And so, yeah.
Do you think you'll be going on to The Voice or even X Factor?
I have my qualms about talent shows.
Why is that?
I believe that there is a bit of manipulation in an individual's image when they enter into competitions like The Voice or The X Factor, because there has to be an element of commercialism, because they want to sell albums, they want to see the scope of a musician's future. But because I feel I need to be individual, I dig my heels in a bit when it comes to changing my style and my sound, because it's taken me such a time to try and develop that on my own. If you want success as a musician, so many people drop out because they give themselves a second option. So I'm just refusing to let myself have that second option. And so I feel it must work. It must happen, because I have nowhere else to go.
It's almost like then you're being true to yourself.
Yeah, I suppose a bit.
All right, just lastly, and then we'll go out with your track. What came first for you then, the lyrics or the music?
The music was definitely a starting point. I didn't really have a lyrical concept. I just had this, how I wanted it to sound. I wanted this bass that would sort of hit you a bit physically with how deep it was and how it sort of shook everything. I'm kind of always writing down lines and different thoughts and feelings. It could be something that I take from an event that's happened or an emotion I've had, or it could just be an image or another form of art that inspires me to write something else. Once I had this base of foundation of sound of the instrumentation and the music, I went, all right, what fits this? And so then Black Noise was born.
Amazing voices and such talent. The CD called Unfolding Stories is available by contacting Padua College. Up next, Kids Down Tunnels.
Lieutenant Colonel of Queenscliff immediately phoned the battery captain.
Service bells must be stopped. Stop. War has been declared. Signal
the
bell to surrender.
Gun crew, fall.
Yes, sir.
This is a warning shot. If he doesn't surrender, then we will fire a second shot. Prepare for action! Set! Range! Prepare to fire! Fire!
During school holidays, Parks Victoria hosts Junior Rangers programs for kids. These discovery programs share hidden mysteries of special places of interest and history on the Mornington Peninsula. Deborah Maher took a trip to Point Nepean National Park with some kids to explore tunnels and gun emplacements and see the place where the first shot was fired just after World War I was declared. First, Tash Wicks, a Parks Victoria Ranger, had this to say about the program.
The kids absolutely love it. It just shows them a little bit about our history, and also going through the military and the commemorative event we're running for 4 years with the Anzacs. So it's just a great experience, beautiful day to get the kids out and about in the park. We're currently running tours at the Capeshank Lighthouse, and we've also got some winter games running here. And then we have some more over at Coolart. There's a bird program, and obviously we've got our big ones down at Wilson's Prom that are running holiday programs in the campgrounds as well.
Along the way, Deborah asked kids what they thought about their experience.
I liked walking through all the cool tunnels and seeing how they stored things and kept them apart. And I like the cool invention of how it pushes up the cannon and then like moves around to shoot. And I like all the views as well.
Well, what about when you just saw where the first shot was fired? How exciting was that?
I thought it was really cool.
I liked all the tunnels and how they were dark. I wish they were a little bit darker though. And that there was elevators that they used to use, and yeah.
Do you think it'd be like living down there, or, you know, no electricity, no hot water?
I don't think it would be that good, because it's pretty cold down there and it would be hard to get to sleep, but it is pretty dark deeper down.
Do you think you'd like to be a soldier when you grow up?
Maybe, like that big gun that we saw.
Okay. And you said you love the tunnel. Were you a bit scared down in the tunnels?
No.
Why not?
Because it was sort of dark and it was fun too.
Great, thank you.
I probably like going to see the guns and how they fired it. The area where the disappearing gun.
I'd like you to tell me what you love today.
Getting my badge and my sticker.
Going in the tunnels because it was like really fun learning about it. Oh.
What did you learn?
I learned about that they only used them twice. I did, the big guns.
What did you think about the gun that was in the ground and then it came up?
I thought it was very cool and I thought how nice it could be and I didn't know how it could exactly come down or up because it was such a big gun. It would be tricky to come up and bring it down, it would.
What was the best thing you saw today then?
The tunnels, they were dark and when you walked around in them, it was almost like you couldn't see any single thing, but you could kind of see things.
Would you like to be a soldier when you grow up?
Maybe.
What about you? Would you like to be a soldier when you grow up?
No. Because, I'm not into war and stuff.
Would you be a soldier when you go out?
No.
Why not?
Just because it'll be hard work and dangerous.
Would you like to be a soldier when you go
out? Yeah, maybe.
Ships, small boats, and yachts can still get...
Because we could fiddle with all the things, and Tash the ranger organised it really well, and she was very nice.
Nash Abbott's great-great-grandfather fired the first shot at Point Nepean.
I found out on the news one day when my dad told me that my nan was on the news and she explained and my dad told me who it was and his name was Jordan Lade and whenever I come here I always like to see the gun.
What do you know about the first shot?
Makes me feel proud that someone in my family did it and my dad was in the army.
And this from a young boy named Jack who gave his story about his experience at Point Nepean.
This tunnel that I went through was the darkest one because it was like it was in the wall and the exit was actually quite good because it also looked like it was in the wall.
And just tell me a little bit about the soldiers when they went down there. They couldn't wear buttons or buckles or their shoes.
Because they couldn't wear them or nails in the shoes because you could set a spark and blow themselves up. And well, if they were carrying the gunpowder and dropped it on a lantern, they could explode themselves and all the tunnels. It was actually quite amazing how they actually found their way because they had lanterns and they had numbers to find their way out and in.
Now tell us about the two cannons that you saw.
The front one was the first cannon that started World War I, the first shot ever. And the back one was the World War II one.
Well, tell us about the shipwrecks then.
Well, if you look out from where one of those cannons were, if you look, there's a big lump of rock at the back with grass on the top. And if you go a little bit back on the right-hand side, you can see a shipwreck, which was one of the German shipwrecks.
These junior ranger programs are very popular and book up quickly. Look out for the next holiday program on the peninsula by visiting parks.vic.gov.au. That brings our program to a close for this week. If you have any news from the street you want to share with our team, please contact RPPFM on 5975 1234. Next week, Eye on the Peninsula will again bring you up to date with issues that matter to you. We hope you can tune in next Tuesday at noon on 98.7 or 98.3 FM in Frankston. You can live stream from our website, rppfm.com.au, and download the RPPFM app. If you miss any Eye on the Peninsula programs, podcasts are available on our website, and check out the Eye on the Peninsula Facebook page. Thanks to Deborah Maher, executive producer of Eye on the Peninsula, ministers and guests, and Kevin Wilcox, our news researcher. And if you're interested in presenting your own radio program on RPPFM or reporting for Eye on the Peninsula, contact our station manager, Brendan Telfer, on 5975 1234. I'm Piers Cunningham. Thanks for your company.